From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is the Tea Party dying or regrouping? I'm Judy Muller, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. 2 years ago, in the midterm elections, members of the Tea Party swept into Congress with the fervor of true believers. But this year, voters sent some of them packing. Those who remain have been demoted from key committee assignments. The movement is still a force within the GOP, but the 2012 election has weakened their position. Today on To the Point, we'll look at what's next for the Tea Party. Can it remain an influential force in American politics? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the real-life heroine of the CIA hunt for bin Laden. She's the inspiration for a new film, but her career isn't following a Hollywood script. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
I'm Judy Muller, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point from PRI. The Tea Party is at a crossroads. 2 years after it burst onto the national stage, there's no clear second act. Later on To the Point, we look at whether the Tea Party can survive as a potent force in American politics. Will it live within the Republican coalition or choose to hold fast to its small government philosophy? After taking a hit in the elections and a drop in its approval ratings in the polls, can the Tea Party learn to compromise? On Reporter's Notebook, she's the woman at the CIA whose role in tracking Osama bin Laden inspired the heroic character in a new film. But her career has not followed the happy narrative of a Hollywood script. We'll take a look at the complicated real-life plot. But first, this news update. In Michigan, long considered a stronghold of organized labor, the state legislature today approved a right-to-work bill limiting union strength in the public sector. Another bill focusing on the private sector was approved last week. The Republican governor, Rick Snyder, is expected to sign both bills as early as tomorrow. Hundreds of protesters gathered at the state capitol today shouting, "Shame on you," even though the outcome of the vote was considered a foregone conclusion. Joining us now, Micheline Maynard, senior editor of Changing Gears. That's a public media project exploring the reinvention of the industrial Midwest. She is also a contributor to Forbes. Welcome, Mickey.
Thank you very much, Judy.
When the governor signs this legislation, what does that mean for unions in Michigan? What do these bills do exactly?
There are two bills. One affects public employee unions and one affects the unions. So, for example, the teachers union in Michigan is covered by one bill, the UAW, the Teamsters would be covered by the other. And essentially, Michigan has been what's called a closed shop state. So if there's a union where you work, you can join the union and pay dues, and if you don't join the union, you still have to pay dues. So basically, most people join because that gives them an opportunity to vote on contracts and union elections, but you don't have a choice about paying dues. What these bills mean is that unions can still organize, and they can ask you to join, and you can agree to join and pay dues, but those who don't want to join don't have to pay the dues, even though a contract might be negotiated that affects them.
That sounds reasonable. What do the unions object to here?
There are a couple of things about unions that you have to keep in mind. First of all, union power lies in membership, and you don't really want a situation where 60% of the workforce are union members, and then they're doing all the heavy lifting for other people. People were saying that this is really right to freeload during the debate today. The other situation is that in many cases, unions are allowed to collect dues through a checkoff on your paycheck. So you just say, oh, I want to join the newspaper guild, and they can take my dues mm-hmm. out of my paycheck, and that's just fine. That goes away. So it makes it harder for unions to convince people to join and then harder for them to collect the money.
Well, this governor campaigned as a moderate, a pragmatist. He said he was not, going to lobby for a right-to-work law. Why did he suddenly get on board with this? And is there a chance he still might veto these bills?
No, he's not going to veto these bills. I think it's probably the closest thing to a sure thing in politics that I've ever seen.
Okay.
He had never come out specifically opposed to right to work, but he said it was not on his agenda. And I always thought he was leaving, you know, a just-in-case thing. And things did, in fact, change in Michigan. The political climate has changed. And one thing that happened last month in November was that unions tried to get a proposal on the ballot. They got a proposal on the ballot to amend the Constitution to prohibit right-to-work laws. And that seemed to overstretch to a lot of people. They also were in the middle of a bunch of ballot proposals amending the Constitution, and people just didn't want the Constitution amended.
Right.
And then second, this is a lame duck legislature. There are more Republicans now than there will be in January, although Republicans will still have a majority. But I think he felt he had political cover with the defeat of Proposal 2 and the larger number of Republicans to go ahead and do this.
Well, once Michigan does this, it will become the 24th right-to-work state. But it's really a turning point, isn't it, in American labor history? You wrote that in Forbes, and it seems to be a real watershed moment for the labor movement.
It is, because Michigan is the home of the UAW and the home of the Teamsters Union, although the Teamsters were actually founded in Chicago. And this is a state where, you know, even today, as labor union membership has dropped to around 12% around the country, it's still about 19% in Michigan. It's a state where labor still has a lot of clout, but that clout just hasn't shown up in the electing people to the legislature and to the governor's chair. We've gone back and forth over the years between who has the seat, the governor's seat, Democrats or Republicans. And so it's a sign of serious trouble for the labor movement. It may just turn out to be a wake-up call. Maybe this is the nadir for labor politically, and they wake up and say, okay, we've got to get back on the horse. And certainly today in Lansing, there were, I think, about 12,000 protesters. So it shows that you can turn people out in numbers if you put your mind to it.
But they didn't turn out in numbers. I mean, very quickly, we have to wrap up. But they didn't turn out in numbers soon. I mean, early on this.
Yeah. And the trick now will be for them to get their candidates elected, because the only way to overturn this legislation will be in the legislature. It can't be done by voters.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mickey Maynard, senior editor of Changing Gears and a contributor to Forbes magazine. In a moment, is the Tea Party movement dead or just resting on To the Point?
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
I'm Judy Muller, back with To the Point. Is the party over for the Tea Party? There is no doubt that the last few months have been rough going for the movement that burst onto the political scene just a few years ago, vowing to cut spending and government regulation. First, according to the polls, the Tea Party is experiencing new lows in terms of public opinion, and that's on top of setbacks in Congress. Representatives Alan West and Joe Walsh, two leading Tea Party figures, lost re-election bids. Several who remain in Congress have been kicked off coveted committees after not going along with GOP leaders on key votes. And Jim DeMint, a Tea Party leader, is resigning his Senate seat to take a job as the head of the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank. Joining us now to assess the damage from all this, Kate Zernike, a national correspondent for The New York Times and author of the book Boiling Mad, Inside Tea Party America. Welcome, Kate. First of all, remind us where this movement came from. What does it stand for?
The Tea Party started just after President Obama was sworn into office in early 2009. And, of course, we all remember the economy was tanking. There was a proposal for a stimulus package, and the earliest Tea Party protests were against the stimulus package. It really accelerated, though, that spring and summer as the president began to push for a health care overhaul.
Well, what's going on now? Is it on the ropes? Are there now moderate voices calling for a less extreme position?
Well, I think what's happened is, and I think this actually, we started to see this in the beginning of 2011, after the Tea Party sweep of 2010. In early 2011, we had the debate over the debt ceiling, and I think the Tea Party's popularity really started to drop then. I think what happened is a lot of people who were very frustrated with government, with the bad economic situation, really were sort of in an anti-incumbent mood. And so they, when they supported the Tea Party, they weren't so much supporting the Tea Party as much as they were opposing what was in place. And the Tea Party really benefited from people not knowing a lot about what it meant, or about what it stood for. And so I think as the Tea Party came, as these new legislators came in and started to do things like, you know, say they weren't going to compromise on the debt ceiling agreement, say that there could be no new revenues, that all the cuts would have to come from spending cuts, we couldn't have any new tax increases. I think even people, you know, polls show that even people who supported the Tea Party disliked these ideas. And so people started to see what the Tea Party looked like. They didn't like it necessarily. And so as a result, they've started to move away from the Tea Party and eventually reject these candidates.
What does the Tea Party stand for exactly? I mean, is it anti kind of a platform or is it for something?
Well, I think it's always been much more anti. I mean, it will say it is for limited government, lower taxes and less spending. But I think that pretty much means, you know, that it's more of a no vote. I mean, it's sort of, you know, I remember an article in The Atlantic at one point calling Ron Paul the Tea Party's brain. And Ron Paul was a congressman, of course, was known as Dr. No, because he was constantly saying no to new budget initiatives. Their feeling was any new spending is bad spending. Any new government program is a bad government program.
Well, is Jim DeMint's departure from the Senate a sign of Tea Party weakness, do you think?
You know, that's a trickier one. I think perhaps it's a recognition on his part that the Tea Party is not going to be as forceful or have as much sway with Republicans in Congress as it did after 2010. And, you know, you see John Boehner, for instance, pretending that there was never a Tea Party caucus in the House. John Boehner 2 years ago was embracing the Tea Party caucus. But I think Jim DeMint his advisors have always said that he feels he didn't love the Senate, and he felt he could have a bigger platform outside the Senate, sort of agitating for change and giving money to candidates he believed in.
Well, were the Tea Party candidates who went to Congress sort of a bunch of idealistic Mr. Smiths, shades of Jimmy Stewart, who are now being hit by harsh realities, or were they more cynical than that?
Well, I think it was a real mix. You know, when we did a story, when the New York Times did a story about this I guess it was just before the 2010 elections, there were certainly some, you know, we looked at Tea Party candidates around the country, and there were certainly some who were running very opportunistically. They weren't necessarily cut from a specific Tea Party mold. They hadn't embraced Tea Party ideas before they were running, but they were very much supported by the Tea Party movement. Others were real ideologues, someone like Justin Amash, for instance, who John Boehner has moved off of some committees. They are, you know, very libertarian, really feel that government has to be stripped down to its barest necessary functions. And I think others were, you know, certainly the overarching theme was fiscal responsibility, and that tended to mean cuts in spending.
All right. I'd like to bring in E.G. Dionne now. He's with the Brookings Institution, a liberal think tank. E.J., you wrote a column after the election saying that the Tea Party was less the wave of the future than a remnant of the past. So is the Tea Party dead?
You never declare a political movement entirely dead. And the truth is that there has always been opinion on the right and far right that the Tea Party spoke for. A lot of their ideas can be traced back first to the opposition to the New Deal, and some of them can be traced back to the John Birch Society. I loved it in Kate's book, a woman quoted saying, oh, they say we're extreme, but they said that about the John Birch Society, too. Now, not all of the Tea Party was like that, but it gives you a sense that this right has been with us for a long time. There was a dissatisfaction in 2010, spurred some on the right with the election of Obama, the size of the stimulus, and the passage of the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, and the Democratic side was demobilized. There were a lot of people upset about the state of the economy. But these ideas were old ideas on the right, and they were never the wave of the future. And I think that what you're seeing in the wake of the 2012 election is a lot of conservatives coming to terms with the fact that this really harsh anti-government view is not where most Americans are at. And I think for the first time in 30 years, really since the rise of Ronald Reagan, you actually see conservatives responding to liberal arguments rather than liberals responding to conservative arguments. Bill Clinton felt obligated to say the era of big government is over back in 1994. Right after the election, you had both Paul Ryan and Marco Rubio giving speeches saying, wait a minute, we're not against government altogether. Wait a minute, we're not just on the side of the rich. I think that's a real sign of a potential sea change in the argument. So the folks in the Tea Party who support these ideas are not going away. A lot of them were active in politics before the Tea Party was formed. A lot of them will stay active. But I think their ideas are in recession as the big recession comes to a close.
Right. Your most recent book, Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. Is there now discontent with discontentment? I mean, is there a backlash against the party, Tea Party?
Well, I think there was a backlash against the Tea Party. And you know, you have two streams of conservatism that overlapped. You obviously had the social conservatism going back to the formation of the moral majority in the late 70s and the Christian Coalition, basically a continuation later on. And then you had this new, very strong strain of anti-government conservatism. A lot of people in the Tea Party, at least half of them also identified with the religious conservative movement. And so I think you saw in this election that extreme statements on the social conservative side were punished, notably in those Senate races in Indiana and Missouri. But I also think that President Obama prevailed on a very big argument. We can talk about how the ads were negative and all of that in the campaign, but there was a really big argument between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama on the role of government, on who should be taxed in our country. And broadly speaking, Obama won that argument. It wasn't a landslide, but it was a solid, solid victory. And I think conservatives are coming to terms with that. And there's a little bit of a reformation, if you will, going on within the conservative movement, which, you know, I'm on the progressive side, so I welcome that. But even if I weren't a progressive, I think I'd welcome it because I don't think we can govern ourselves effectively if you have one side of politics willing, for example, to use a fight over the debt ceiling and threatening the credit of our country to win a budget fight. And I think we may be slowly moving past that.
Well, Kate Zernike, The New York Times, can a movement born from a sort of take-no-prisoners approach, the Tea Party, mature into a movement that can govern in the traditional give-and-take of Washington? Or does it actually negate its very essence if it does that?
Well, I don't know that it negates its essence, but I do think that E.J. Raes is sort of hinted at this in what he was saying. You know, libertarianism has never had much luck moving from a sort of a protest movement into, or a, you know, a think tank movement into government, because it's very hard to, you know, what they're arguing for is a drastically reduced government, and it's arguing for undoing the federal state as we've known it since pretty much the New Deal. So it's, you know, it's not a very practical system.
All right, let's bring in Jeffrey Lord right now. He's a former Reagan White House political director and now a contributing editor for The American Spectator. Jeffrey, are rumors of the Tea Party's death exaggerated?
Greatly, greatly. And I see my old friend EJ had a column back in October saying something like the Tea Party was dead. I don't think so at all. And I would expand the notion here. The Tea Party is really, to a considerable degree, just the latest, perhaps the most attention is paid to it for the fact that it sprung to life in an animated sense in the early Obama years. But it's really still part and parcel of the conservative movement. And the conservative movement has been pronounced dead more times than I can think of. I remember being in the Oval Office with President Reagan shortly after the 1986 elections when we lost control of the Senate. And there were columns aplenty saying, well, that's it for conservatism. We're, you know, the whole thing is over. This was its apogee. It's now done, toast, over. That isn't so. There's two things at work here, not only conservative ideas, but number two, when you stand back and look at the progressive movement as an arc of history here, a lot of this is coming to fruition in terms of its financial spending and all of this kind of thing. $16.5 trillion in debt, the unfunded obligations for Medicare and Social Security, et cetera. At a certain point, this is just mathematically unsustainable.
Well, let me ask you what your definition is of the Tea Party. I mean, it didn't start as a cohesive movement. What do you think it stands for? Who are we talking about when we talk about the Tea Party?
Yeah, primarily, I believe, you know, this was a grassroots uprising very much in response, I think, as EJ accurately said a few minutes ago, to the economic, and Kate was saying, is to the economic situation in terms of the Obama administration and Obamacare, as it were, and the stimulus and the notion that we were just going to open the public purse and dump everything out and then tax everybody up the wazoo to replace it. And at a certain point, I think that's unsustainable. But I think that is the core of the Tea Party. I think there's been a lot of demonization of the Tea Party, some of which I think was a quite deliberate strategy on the part of the Obama White House and some of their media allies. But I think at the core of it, it was an economic message. I do disagree. I don't think that Ron Paul is a significant player in the Tea Party, per se. I mean, he's a libertarian. I certainly have disagreed. I'm a basic Reagan-Kemp Republican conservative, and I wouldn't agree with Ron Paul on a lot of things. So I don't think that he really, in fact, played. At least when I would go to these Tea Party rallies, I would not see any evidence of that.
Well, Ron Paul is a hero of this movement, and he's now talking about a more moderate approach. I mean, somebody must be listening. EJ, what do you think?
Well, you know, just to go back to the point about that column I wrote in October, what I wrote in October is that the right wing has lost the election of 2012. I certainly have never argued and never will argue that the conservative movement died, because both liberalism and conservatism have been declared dead many times. I once wrote a book on liberalism called They Only Look Dead. And what I do think, however, is that this particular iteration, an unusually right-wing form of conservatism, suffered a real setback in this election. And it wasn't just the election result. It was that when Mitt Romney, at the end of the campaign, particularly in that first debate, which was probably his finest moment in the campaign, decided he had to do something to win the election, what he did was move away from the far right or fairly right wing positions he had to take to win in the primaries, and to look like a much more moderate conservatism. And so what I think you're seeing is that, you know, if you want to put it in terms of the Tea Party is dead, well, those people are still going to be in politics. But I think a particularly hard right form of politics suffered a real setback. It was a two-year, the movement had a kind of two-year life. They rose in protest in 2010. And I think conservatism is going to move on, and I really hope it moves on.
Jeffrey Lord, given the setbacks to the party, the Tea Party, should it learn to work within the traditional GOP, especially when it comes to the fiscal cliff negotiations?
Well, I would argue, first of all, that the reason Mitt Romney didn't win is because, A, he was not a conservative, and, B, he didn't run as a conservative. So, I mean, there was nothing Reagan-esque, if you will, about Mitt Romney. And, in fact, in the studies after the election, we found that, you know, fewer Republicans voted for him than voted, for heaven's sakes, for John McCain, who was certainly no conservative either. So I do think that was a problem with the Romney campaign, which, frankly, conservatives argue has been going on since Republicans nominated Thomas Dewey twice. I mean, this goes on.
Well, we're going to come back to this, and we're going to have some more time to talk about the Tea Party and whether it's still a potent force in Washington after a brief break. Back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
I'm Judy Muller in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. We're talking about the Tea Party. Has it burned out, or is it just biding its time before staging a comeback? Kate Zernike is the national correspondent for the New York Times and author of the book Boiling Mad, Inside Tea Party America. What do you think about the origins of the Tea Party and whether it has a lasting quality to it?
Well, look, I think that, you know, the Tea Party does represent certain strains in American politics, American conservatism that we've seen for more than a generations now, I should say, since at least the 60s. You know, when I wrote my book, a lot of characters in my book would say, a lot of people I interviewed in my book and people I focused on would say, you know, what we want to be is the MoveOn.org of the right. You know, they admired what MoveOn, despite not being liberal, they admired what MoveOn had done to sort of pull the Democratic Party in a certain direction, to work within the Democratic Party. And I think the Tea Party, it never wanted to be a third party. It was always going to work within the Republican Party. And I think they did that. And I think in many ways, the way we could describe them now is not unlike the MoveOn of the right. Because if you look at MoveOn, it's a constituency within the Democratic Party, but it no longer pulls as much opinion within Democratic leaders as it did in, say, 2004 or 2006. So I think the Tea Party, again, it's, you know, in 2010 and perhaps to a lesser degree in 2012, the Tea Party, I think a lot of Republicans were really afraid of the Tea Party and felt that they had to bend toward it. Now the Tea Party is more an interest group within the Republican Party, and it does not have as much influence as it once did.
Well, joining us now is Chris Littleton. He knows something about the founding principles of the Tea Party. He's the owner of the libertarian consulting firm Littleton & Associates. He was previously co-founder of a statewide coalition of Tea Party groups in Ohio. Chris, what do you think of Kate Zernike's description of the beginnings of the Tea Party and where it is now?
Sure. I guess one of the things we should start with is the great moments that were the beginnings of the Tea Party actually started in 2007. It didn't start in 2009, and largely those things revolved around libertarian principles and were very frustrated with George W. Bush. I'm one of those people who had these first meetings in our homes in 2008 and said, this is absolutely crazy what is happening. And we're frankly disgusted at the two choices that were John McCain and Barack Obama as president in 2008. So the origins, as I tell a lot of people, there was sort of fuel on the ground well before 2009. What happened with regards to sort of that rise, and I've personally written an article, and I got a lot of flack even within my own peer groups, called the death of the Tea Party. I completely agree that the Tea Party, as it was popularly defined, is completely dead. And this has been a stance of mine for almost two straight years.
That's an amazing thing for you to say. You are...
Yeah, and I said it a couple of years ago, so it won't come as shock to anyone in my peer groups any longer. But the reason I said it is the Tea Party was a protest movement in its purest form. If you looked at what it was emulating, it was basically looking at what the Boston Tea Party was. Well, the Boston Tea Party was not a continuance of, or the American Revolution was not a continuance of the Boston Tea Party. The Boston Tea Party was a spark that ignited a moment that people said, you know what, that's a narrative that I can relate to. That's effectively what ended up happening in 2010, and I agree with a lot of what the other people on the show are saying, and that is there was a lot of voters that were just kind of generally disgusted. The economy was down. There were a lot of problems, and there was an anti-incumbent sentiment that existed at that time. And so this narrative comes up, and then a lot of people embraced it. It had absolutely nothing to do with, do I believe in the fundamental limitation of government? No. I mean, a lot of them don't, and I think that's what we saw happen in Congress with a lot of these representatives who sort of had that banner for a little while. Well, it was a banner of convenience. It actually wasn't a belief system. And so if you look at sort of the nuts and bolts and the roots and the individuals who are sort of leading and pushing these things, they're all there, and frankly, they're doing far more amazing and impactful things. But we all had to grow up because most of us were new to politics. I've never done anything political in my life. And being new to politics, we had to experience this moment that was the reality that protests don't change anything.
All right,
protests don't accomplish policy. Protests aren't going to advance these ideas that we believe in. So we had to focus on the means to accomplish those things. It's a story for another day, but some truly amazing policy-changing things have accomplished in Ohio, where I live, and a number of other states, because we set down those protest signs and we admitted to ourselves, this isn't the future.
All right. Well, Jeffrey Lord, you're a former Reagan White House political director, now a contributing editor for The American Spectator. How do you respond to Chris Littleton? You know, the Tea Party's dead, basically.
Well, I think what Chris is verbalizing here is something that perhaps EJ understands even better than I do, that when ideas are created over a particular point of view and injected into the American political system, like the early progressives in the 1890s, they may come about in the form of protest in a great many ways. And then the protests sort of go exactly the way that Chris is describing, but some of the ideas remain behind, and one of the two major parties will pick them up. In that case, it was the Democratic Party. I think that what the Tea Party has done here was inject a new set of ideas or new approaches to some things. They are being slowly grafted as we speak into the psyche of the Republican Party and the conservative movement. It energizes it, and then the larger mass moves on. So I think in that sense, he may be right. But that is sort of the history of ideas in this. This is why third and fourth parties never work, because they can't sustain themselves. But their ideas sometimes do stick, and they are picked up by one of the other major parties, and they go on. And I think that may be what's happening as we speak with the Tea Party.
Well, given that thought, what do you think about John Boehner and how he's handling the budget negotiations? Are the establishment Republicans sounding too willing to bend?
I would say yes, and I have argued that. I believe that one of the keys to the success of the Reagan presidency was that he did exactly the opposite of what his establishment Republican predecessors had done in terms of, for instance, approaching the Cold War. Ronald Reagan was a good negotiator. He knew how to negotiate. I think that Speaker Boehner and some of these other folks, you know, are basically running up the white flag and saying, okay, let's start from here, without having an understanding of what President Obama is really about and how to deal with it. So I would say that Speaker Boehner does have a problem, and going after House conservatives who don't toe the line, as it were, is a mistake that sometimes powerful speakers make, and it never works well as a result.
E.J. Dionne with the Brookings Institution, the Tea Party demographic is predominantly older and whiter than the general population of America. And was that sort of a recipe for political suicide from the get-go?
Well, it's not necessarily a recipe for political suicide, but it does raise questions about the longevity of the movement. It is striking that the voters who are under 35, a more diverse group of voters, by the way, ethnically and racially, than voters over 65, are overwhelmingly or pretty strongly on the Democratic and moderate to liberal side of things. I want to thank Jeffrey for his graciousness and he's right, of course, that movements inject ideas into politics. I think the striking thing about the Tea Party is that it wasn't really new ideas. It was a new form for fairly traditional conservative ideas. It was old-time religion, and I'm not saying that critically. I still like some of FDR's ideas, but it was, it was very old-fashioned politics. And just to pick up on a point Tim made, which I think is very important, what a lot of us who are liberals didn't fully understand was the backlash against President Bush on parts of the right. There was a real reaction among some parts of the right for President Bush's openness or, being in favor of immigration reform. There was an opposition to the fact that he spent a lot of money, even though those of us on the liberal side would note he spent a lot of that money in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so there was an opposition to Bush brewing before Obama came along. And I think the Tea Party was born out of the convulsion between that initial conservative reaction or part of the conservative movement's reaction against Bush and then Obama's presidency. But last quick point, if you're talking about the future, in the exit poll, 21% of those who voted said they supported the Tea Party. 30% said they opposed the Tea Party. I think that gives you a pretty good sense of where public opinion is now and why a lot of Republicans, including some very conservative Republicans, are probably going to slowly back away from a Tea Party identification. And you can never resist noting that President Reagan was willing to raise taxes
exactly
when it was necessary.
Well, let's get back to that for a minute, because Jeffrey Lord said that Boehner is too conciliatory, and yet Reagan did know how to compromise when he needed to. You mentioned a comment by Tim. I think you meant Chris Littleton. It's libertarian consulting firm Littleton & Associates. And Chris, I'd like to ask you about that. I mean, is John Boehner too conciliatory? I mean, at what point does government get done here? Somebody has to compromise.
Well, I'm going to ask a question before we even get to the answer, and that is, does it make a difference? And now this is the classic sort of libertarian contrarian position, but those of us who are watching this are sort of watching it really more or less as political theater There's a lot of political positioning that's going on here. But let's imagine that, you know, absolutely nothing was done and the tax cuts, you know, expire and that, you know, sequestration kicks in. We've got to change all the spending. That's horrible. Just the end of the world is going to come. And really what it means is that we're going to spend about 1% or 2% less per year than we were before. I mean, this is the entire rhetoric that has become this debate to me is flawed from the first moment. And we're still not even in the realm of discussion about serious things that affect the future of the United States. It's just, to me, that the entire debate is political positioning, and it's who's going to have a chip at the next table and who will position themselves better for re-election and holding seats in majorities. And so this is, and I think, on a personal level, I come a lot closer to embodying what the American people feel about what's happening in D.C., is that we have arguments of personalities and politicians, and yes, that is an extremely populist way to look at these things, but I think it is reflected in this last election that we saw turnout was down in a significant number of states, even in key swing states like Ohio. I mean, people just, they weren't buying either product. And if we're going to discuss polls, let's talk about what people are seeing. I ran a huge ID campaign just for some stuff that I was working on, and we found with Obama voters, a significant percentage, over 70% of those voters, actually wanted a less intrusive role of government in their lives. So when you define candidates versus individual issues, concepts, and philosophies, they're very different. The American people haven't quite disassociated belief systems, parties, and candidates. When that moment occurs, I'm very confident libertarian principles triumph.
Well, concepts and philosophies don't sit down at the bargaining table, and I'd like to get back to a moment to Jeffrey Lords, give him a chance to respond to E.J. Dionne about President Reagan compromising in terms of allowing taxes to be raised. You know, that is a negotiator, correct?
Well, of course, the Reagan view of this ever after was that he was taken to the cleaners uncharacteristically by good Republicans like Bob Dole and Howard Baker and Pete Domenici, who at the time were all in various Senate leadership positions, and that they said, you know, Mr. President, if you go along with a dollar in tax increases, we'll come up with the Democrats have promised $3 in spending cuts, and Reagan said, fine, and the first happened and not the second. In other words, that is in essence the feeling today that is going on. That this is, you know, in the process of happening yet again, but we're that much further down the road, and we can afford it even less than we can afford it then. Ronald Reagan was, in my view, in my totally biased view, a great American president, but he wasn't perfect. He did make mistakes, and I think he was one of the first to acknowledge later that was a mistake.
Well, if the economy suffers because fiscal cliff negotiations fail, I mean, the polls indicate the American people will place the blame on Republicans, and wouldn't the most of that blame go to the most intransigent faction of the GOP, that would be the Tea Party. Let me ask you that, Chris. Chris Littleton, what do you think? I mean, is the blame going to fall on the GOP and the Tea Party if the fiscal cliff
thing? There's an unbelievably common misnomer, and so I'm, you know, sitting in D.C. and I talk with these congressmen from time to time, or at least did for an extended period of time. And there were not Tea Party caucus meetings. This thing didn't actually exist. There weren't people that were working together. There wasn't a list that necessarily existed. This was something that Michelle Bachmann for a time trumpeted, and a lot of people said, hey, that sounds like a great idea. But with regards to some kind of unified base of any individuals, it doesn't exist. It just never did exist. It was a useful tool for D.C. to, and even Boehner to use for an extended period of time. But now that it's not there, I think it's very hard to place the blame on people who don't exist, don't associate, and I mean, many have nothing to do with that process and certainly don't even identify with a Tea Party nomenclature. So, no, I don't know how you could pull that. It's very much a red herring.
Okay. Well, Kate Zernike had to leave us, but I want to give each of the three of you remaining, you know, a brief moment because we have to wrap this up. Give us a prediction. Where is this Tea Party movement going? Can it evolve? And if it does, is it still the Tea Party? Let's start with you, Chris.
As I kind of related to earlier, you know, there are individuals that are out there I don't think are going away, and they're advancing significant, you know, policy specific to states and advocating for, I think, you know, bridge over policy in a great number of places. I don't think that's going to change. I think the ideas are here to stay. And one of the most encouraging things to me is on college campuses, one of the fastest growing groups in the United States is Young Americans for Liberty. Now, these are true liberty-minded people, liberty-minded individuals that are drawing significantly. Lots of their numbers are disaffected Obama supporters.
Okay.
I've had conversations with a lot of them. So, no, I don't think the ideas, I don't think the concepts are going away. But in practicality, the term, yes, I think it's gone. That influence that you saw through, you know, 2010, yes, I think that's gone, and it's probably not going to come back.
Jeffrey Lord, is it gone?
Yeah, I agree. I think Chris has got it about right. I think it's going. The central idea is the Tea Party will be absorbed into the larger conservative movement. What works will be kept. What does not seem to resonate will be cast adrift. I do think that Ron Paul, while I disagree with him, particularly on foreign policy issues, I think his contribution here, and I should say this, is to do exactly what I was talking about with, you know, 19th century progressives. He has injected a whole series of ideas in domestic politics that I think are going to be studied closely and absorbed to some degree by the Republican Party and the conservative movement over time. And I think that's actually what's in process right now.
E.J. Dionne of the Brookings Institution, your prediction.
First, I can't resist saying I think I have more respect for Ronald Reagan than Jeffrey does, and I probably don't get to say that too often because I think he knew what he was doing when he raised taxes. He knew the budget was getting out of line, and I think what we're seeing right now is a less ideological approach to taxes. Yes, opposing 90% tax rates may well be a matter of principle and ideology. Moving taxes a few points up on the wealthy is not. More broadly, I think Chris said something very interesting when he talked about that poll saying that 70% of Americans want a less intrusive role for government. Well, of course, a lot of liberals answering that question may have been thinking about abortion or other social issues. I think we are a mixture of libertarian and, if you will, communitarian inclinations. Americans are not libertarian when it comes to saying we don't want the government to help the elderly get medical care. They're not libertarian when it comes to public education. There are a lot of areas where Americans may be anti-government in principle, but actually want government to solve some problems. And in that sense, I think that the Tea Party's ideas are going to recede because it's a coming to terms with this fundamental pragmatism, and I think a very slight tilt in the progressive direction on the part of the American people, and I think this election showed that.
Well, let me just ask a left-turn question to you, E.J., while I've got you. What about the Democrats? Can they rest easy given this discord among Republicans and the fading Tea Party?
My favorite book title of a political memoir was from Larry O'Brien, the former Democratic National Chair, who wrote a book called No Final Victories. The beautiful thing about a democracy is no side permanently wins, so they can't rest easy. And I think the obligation on Obama and the Democrats is to show they mean what they said when they said we can restore broadly shared economic growth so that the bottom and the middle go up as well as the top. And I think they're going to be judged by their capacity to do that. And they've got 4 years to prove they can do it.
Jeffrey Lord, what do you think of the Democrats have got to do right now?
Well, I think what they should do is exactly what President Obama wants them to do. I mean, I very much believe that President Obama, like President Reagan, campaigned and said he would do X, and he should try and do X. I think that the difference here is in the set of principles, but I read Larry O'Brien's book, and that's right. There are no final victories here. I think the interesting thing that he will have to deal with, as always, is the consequences of his ideas once put into action. I remember that President Reagan liked to say of Lyndon Johnson that he declared war on poverty, and poverty won. So things are never, or at least not necessarily, turning out the way you think they might. And President Obama has the ball to a considerable extent here, and he will be held responsible. And as always in the American system, there will be consequences, good and bad.
Well, thank you to all of our guests, Kate Zernike of the New York Times, Jeffrey Lord with the American Spectator, E.J. Dionne of the Brookings Institution, and Chris Littleton with the libertarian consulting firm Littleton & Associates. The movie Zero Dark Thirty premieres next week, and it features a headstrong young woman as a CIA operative who doggedly tracks down Osama bin Laden. That character is based on a real person whose real-life career at the CIA has followed a more troubled script. More in a moment on To the Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Judy Muller, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The woman who serves as the inspiration for the heroine of the movie Zero Dark Thirty is known in the film as Maya.
There are two narratives about the location of Osama bin Laden. The one that you're most familiar with is that UBL is hiding in a cave in the tribal areas, that he's surrounded by a large contingent of loyal fighters. But that narrative is pre-9/11 understanding of UBL.
Maya's not a real name, but much about the character in the movie is reportedly accurate. She spent years pursuing her conviction that Al-Qaeda's courier network would lead to bin Laden, and that conviction proved correct. But her real-life career has followed a more problematic script, according to an article today by Washington Post intelligence reporter Greg Miller. He joins us now. Greg, describe this woman for us. What's happened to her since bin Laden was killed?
Well, she's clearly had some career ups and downs since bin Laden was killed. She was given a very prestigious medal and award by the CIA for her work, but she was also passed over for a substantial promotion at the agency. And she has also sparred and clashed with some of her colleagues over credit for the mission. The people close to her say that she's a very headstrong person, combative personality, very determined, and that those aspects of her come through in the film.
She sounds a little bit like the character Carrie in Homeland on HBO. Very driven, very smart. Is there a sexist aspect to the way she's been treated at the CIA, do you think?
Well, I think that's a legitimate question. I mean, the agency still has a bit of that reputation. It's there are more women in the top ranks of the CIA than ever before now. But still, the agency's never been run by a woman. Its clandestine service, which is the division that sends spies overseas, has never been run by a woman. And that part of the agency really still remains a bit of a men's club.
It's hard to believe that she'd be passed over for a promotion after what she did. I mean, describe what she actually did in the hunt for bin Laden.
Well, she's what's known by the agency as a targeter, which is a little more nuanced a job description than it sounds. The counterterrorism work comes down to looking at vast amounts of data and trying to identify, you know, links in that data that help form a picture. So she's looking at nodes in Al-Qaeda networks that are vulnerable to it, whether it's recruiting them as informants or hitting them with drone strikes. Her job is to target those individual nodes in the network that can help bring it down.
Well, I know you talked to someone who worked with her at the CIA, and how did that source describe her?
As a driven but also difficult personality. I mean, even her ardent defenders acknowledge that part about her. And, you know, CIA officials I talked to say that the work kind of attracts that sort of mindset and personality, so it's not that big a surprise.
Well, your source also said that the CIA is kind of a funny place, very insular. I mean, expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, this person had went so far as to say it's like middle school, but with clearances, because it can be so petty at times.
Well, do you think we're ever going to know this person's real name? And if she leaves the agency, is there a book contract waiting for her, do you think?
Oh, I'm positive that there is. I mean, she is given no indication that she's ready to leave her work. She's moved on to another counterterrorism assignment at CIA, so she's, as far as I know, not planning to leave the agency. But I imagine that someday that we will know more about her. I don't know how far off that day is.
Well, there was some controversy about her talking to the filmmakers in the first place, was there not?
There's a controversy in general about the CIA talking with the filmmakers. I mean, they really opened the doors for these filmmakers. They saw this as a huge PR boon after the bin Laden raid. So she was among a group of CIA officers who were made available to the filmmakers. What's a bit of question now is whether there was any classified information that was shared inappropriately, or whether she or others had outside contacts with the filmmakers beyond those kind of sanctioned sessions that took place at agency headquarters.
Well, those filmmakers also talked to top brass in the military, even SEAL Team 6 people, so why would she come under controversy?
Well, especially given that it was a sanctioned collaboration. She didn't go out of school. It's not like she spoke with them without the approval of the CIA. But you know, that this has become a very political issue. The collaboration with between the agency and the filmmakers has really upset many members of Congress who have called for investigations into this, and you know, particularly Republicans who were worried that this film was going to be basically a re-election ad for President Obama.
Have you seen the film? Is it an accurate depiction of what happened?
I have not seen it yet. I'm scheduled to see a premiere this week. I've talked to our film reviewer about it, and I've seen portions of it and read all the press materials on it, but obviously it's getting a lot of praise and attention.
Yes, it certainly is, and I guess it premieres next week, correct? Yes.
Yep, that's right.
Okay, well, Greg Miller, intelligence reporter for the... Okay, let me ask you yet another question.
Okay.
I guess we still have 1 minute where I can ask you yet another question about this woman. What do you think is going to happen when this film comes out and this woman is the hero of the thing? Is this like a recruiting tool for the CIA, for new young women to join?
You know, I think that was the agency's calculation when they made this film. I mean, this is the most successful operation in the agency's history. The depiction in this movie, you know, is not all positive. It opens with a harrowing torture scene in which the CIA is waterboarding a prisoner, and it's very brutal and graphic. Hmm. But ultimately, this is, you know, one of their huge success stories, and I'm sure that it will serve as a recruiting poster of sorts for them.
Okay, well, thank you so much for giving us your time. Greg Miller, intelligence reporter for The Washington Post. Today's program was produced by Anna Scott, Christian Bordalt, Francis Anderton. The technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Judy Muller, sitting in for Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.